Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you for returning to the show as we get towards the rear end now of 2009. I don't know what happened to this year. You turn round and boy, we're in September very nearly already. As I record this, a nice sunny day in London town, but we've had a very variable summer here. Some very heavy rain, some cool temperatures, and some incredible heat too. I don't know what that says about the way our weather's going. I think, as we say up here, all bets are off about the way things may go. I'm not sure. I'm just grateful to look out of the window as I speak these words and see a little bit of sunshine across the trees here. So that's rather nice. Now then, to business. Thank you for the great response that I've had to the new website. Adam Cornwell, working very, very hard on that. Thanks, Adam. We've got the new theme tune, of course, that's been running for a few months. Martin, shout out to you. Haven't mentioned you recently, so thank you very much for the work that you did on that. And thank you again for the great email response that we've had to the show. I'm getting some statistical traffic on downloads for it. Looking very healthy, so let's develop it. The latest email that I've had was from Peter in Malaysia. Hello, Peter. He says that he downloads the show and listens to it, wait for this, on his way to Kuala Lumpur. Now, I've never been to Kuala Lumpur, and I can't imagine what Malaysia is like. But I've got all sorts of mental images, Peter, of you on the way to wherever you're going in Kuala Lumpur, listening to my show. And I'm very, very grateful. Apparently, Peter found me on a website called British Icons. I'm not sure whether I'm one of those at all, but apparently I'm there. So, as I say, thank you for the response. Please keep it coming. If you have questions for the show, go to the website. You can email directly. Lots to get through this time. Some big-name guests on here. Three conversations from my recent shows for City Talk 105.9. Last week, as I speak these words, in Liverpool I was there. Three of the people I spoke to, and we'll be including, coming up right now, some very brief clips of those conversations. They are Timothy Good, UFO expert, Reg Presley, lead singer of the Troggs, 1960s band, had a hit with Wild Thing, also wrote Love Is All Around for Wet 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 back in the 90s. He's on because he's a crop circle enthusiast, and we'll also talk to Uri Geller about, well, the many, many things that Uri Geller is involved in at the moment, including his show The Successor, which we understand is about to come to England. The big guest, though, this time is James Van Praagh, somebody who was on the show a couple of years ago. Wonderful to talk with him, and we'll be crossing to him after we've gone through these three items. The first of which is Timothy Good, and I spoke to him on the day that Britain's Ministry of Defence decided to release some new UFO files. Maybe we are visited by creatures from another planet. How do you know that that is not the case? So before you diss it, listen to this man. This is Timothy Good. He is, for my money, the best UFO expert and writer on this field that this country has to offer. Timothy, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So, Timothy, I don't know if you've seen the detail of these things being released by the MOD. If you did, which of them piqued your interest?
Well, I haven't had a chance, quite frankly. There's 4,000 pages, and they were only released at midnight last night. So there's an awful lot. There's 800 reports there.
Now, isn't that interesting? Because the last time you and I talked about UFOs on this radio station, I was filling in for Pete Price at nighttime here. And I said to you, and I think you agreed at the time, that a great way to cover up what is really going on, if anything is going on, is to release so much information that people can't make a head or tail of it. They can't find the interesting nuggets because they're buried in thousands and thousands of pages of stuff that's not really interesting.
That's right. And the most sensitive material, of course, for very good reasons, does not get released, as I've already discussed before. Based on the last release, which was about 6 months ago, I think, none of them was classified higher than top secret. Higher than confidential, I should say, having been billed as top secret files released, Ministry of Defence releases top secret files at last, which is absolute nonsense. There were none. There were not one top secret or secret file. None of them was classified higher than confidential, which is about the lowest grade of an intelligence classification you can get.
So I've heard you say this before, and I've heard many others, both sides of the Atlantic, say this before. There's no point in releasing this material, is there?
Well, yes, there is, because some of them are very interesting. The majority of the reports are actually letters from members of the public and correspondence between the public and the Ministry of Defence, from researchers such as myself and from witnesses. But there's also a lot of pretty dull stuff, sort of minutes of meetings, between MOD branches, between MOD staff. So, but some of it, I'm sure, will be interesting. I'm very keen to find out what all the latest, if there's anything new that hasn't been released about the Britain's so-called Roswell equivalent, the famous Rendlesham Forest case, which happened out just outside the twin U.S. Air Force bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because in about 10 minutes from now, we're going to be running my interview with Larry Warren, who is an American Liverpudlian who was actually there.
Excellent, excellent. Well, from what I've seen from all of the Ministry of Defence papers that I was able to obtain, thanks to Lord Hill Norton, former Chief of Defence Staff, who gave them to me, and that was quite a long time ago, the Ministry of Defence position is that it was of no defence significance whatsoever, which is absolutely farcical.
Well, even if you are a sceptic, the reports of what happened on that night and the audio recordings, and I think there are video recordings of what happened on that night.
Video or photographic material has not been released.
But audio material has been released, and that is chilling enough.
Yes, it is. Colonel Holt's letter to the Ministry of Defence, which was sent about 2 or 3 weeks after the incident, was ignored. And for the simple reason I can tell you is that the Americans are in charge of the UFO situation, just as they're in charge of our nuclear situation.
Tim, what would you say to... We have a guy on this radio station called Duncan Barks. He's a very good broadcaster. He does the breakfast show here, but he takes a very dim view of UFOs, ufology, and the people who believe in the things that you believe in.
Okay.
What would you say to him?
Well, I would say that he hasn't studied the evidence. If he looks at my book, Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, he can see numerous previously classified top secret documents which prove just how seriously the subject is taken by the military intelligence community, if not the general public. But regarding Rendlesham Forest, Bentwaters, Woodbridge case, Colonel Holt, about 2 months ago, made this statement: "I wish to make it perfectly clear that the UFOs I saw were structured machines moving under intelligent control and operating beyond the realm of anything I have ever seen before or since. I believe the objects that I saw at close quarters were extraterrestrial in origin, and that the security services of both the United States and United Kingdom were and have been complicit in trying to subvert the significance of what occurred at Rendlesham by use of well-practiced methods of disinformation."
Always informative, always good value. Timothy Good, British UFO expert. I spoke with him at City Talk 105.9 last week, as I record these words, about the release of 4,000 pages of new UFO documentation. Well, new to us anyway. Let's see if anything comes out from them. Somebody else who I've known for a few years, and I think he's always good value on his chosen subjects, is Reg Presley, lead singer of the 1960s band The Troggs. They are still out there and still touring. Good luck to them, by the way, with some gigs they're doing in Germany coming very, very soon. But I spoke with Reg Presley about crop circles, which has been his interest in many for many, many years, and also his plan for a movie.
It's all about 2012, and, well, let's say it comes through to 2012 when everything messes up a bit.
Well, that's right, because a lot of people, including the Mayans with the Mayan calendar, they say 2012 is where the world will come unstuck.
Well, that's where we become in the middle of the universe, and I don't mean the round middle, I mean the middle of the thickness. We come exactly in the middle of that, and we are the nearest to our sun that we get, and the world isn't going to end like they say, but it's going to end as we know it.
Do you believe that, Reg? Do you believe that?
Wait and see.
Right. What's the movie going to be again? What's it going to be called?
Genesis.
Okay. Now, listen, we're talking about crop circles because that's been your big interest among the loads of interests that you do have. From the investigations that you've done since, what, 1990, do you believe that, you know, some of them at least are genuine?
I think 98% are man-made. But that's not to say that they're hoaxes, because there was a couple of guys years ago that were saying that they did them, and they got all the press down to a field just south of Stonehenge.
And they made a video of it, yeah.
They said, look, we made this. What they didn't know, though, is we were flying around, and as we flew around, in the bottom of the picture that we've got that we can show them is an exact replica of what they did, but they didn't even know it had been done.
So something created that.
Yeah.
And what and do you think? Guys, what's your best guess as to what created that?
Well, one of those guys stood in a crop circle one night and blue ice hit him on the head. He had an inch scar that had to be sewn up. You know, you say, well, where did that come from? Well, we know where it came from. It came from a toilet in an airplane and froze as it came out, you know, when it was full.
So hang on, he was standing in a crop circle and he was hit by ice.
It hit the right guy.
He was in a field in the middle of a crop circle and some ice from a plane's toilet hit him.
Yep.
Okay, and you think that's poetic justice?
Yes.
Okay. So look, we haven't got very long. We've only got a minute or so. If some of these crop circles that appear, and there are still crop circles appearing, although they don't get in the papers, but this summer there have been some in the West Country, where do you think they come from?
Well, it all depends. If you go look at them and see, don't forget there's a lot of technology today, whereas they used a little string on their head with a piece of wire to get straight lines when they were doing it and hoaxing them. Now we've got lasers, and so you can actually make some beautiful ones, but it's the ones that aren't there one minute when you fly over and you film in, and it happened at Stonehenge. They flew round it with some Americans showing them Stonehenge. Crop circle wasn't there, went back to Thruxton. The whole journey took 3/4 of an hour, and when they came back round the second time, 3/4 of an hour, somebody or something had made a crop formation with 150 circles, and it was a gem. They called it the Julia set. It was a beautiful. You cannot do that physically. It's like saying you built the pyramids in a year.
So there is something happening, and people say, well, they have various theories that it might be extraterrestrial. It might do with power, vortexes, vortices here on Earth.
It
we just don't know.
Magnetism as well, we figure, because birds have been known, geese have been known to actually fly in formation in their V shape, and then when they get to the outside of a circle, flutter as though they've hit an invisible brick wall, split apart, go round it, and then join up into a V and carry on. And you know they eat somewhere and they sleep somewhere else, and they go in a straight line. A countryman knows that.
So you're absolutely convinced that some of these crop circles are not created by men in their mid-40s on sit-on mowers?
That's right.
We like Reg Presley, man who's been interested for many years in crop circles and also the lead singer of the ongoing success story that is the Troggs. Nice one, Reg. Somebody else we like here is Uri Geller. I spoke with him mainly about his TV show, The Successor.
What I'm doing today, Howard, I have a very successful television series. It's live, and it's called The Successor, and I'm looking for the next Uri Geller. It has been already televised in 15 countries. The next country I'm going to is Greece, and it's 9 weeks sitting in that country that is televising the show, and it's quite amazing because I meet extraordinary individuals.
And you started this, I seem to remember, in Israel. Was it about a year or two ago?
I started it about 3.5 years ago, and in Israel it broke the historical rating records of Israel. And it was bought up by NBC in America. And then, you know, it went to the rest of the world, like places like Germany, Holland, Hungary, Turkey, Russia. In Russia, it was actually the first time that the Russian government channel, like, you know, comparing it to the BBC, that had a live show ever in its history.
Wow. And this show has been, as you rightly say, enormous. I've looked at some of the viewing figures for it, and you know they are. You always pack them in whenever you go on the television. Surprises me that this show has not been done here in the UK, has it?
It's coming to England next year.
Right. So next we have to wait till 2010.
You'll probably see it on ITV.
And how do you get potential, I don't want to call them contestants, but participants for this show? How do you find them?
Well, each country, they engage a massive production company. And the producers look for performers. It's very much like the selection to Pop Idol or American Idol or The X Factor or Britain Got a Talent. Lots of people come and show us their, you know, abilities and skills. I do not choose myself. I prefer to detach myself from the process of the selections and the auditions. I want to be totally neutral when I meet these individuals on the show.
So you don't want to know anything about it in advance so that you can go into it with a completely clean mind?
Exactly, right. And I do that. And of course, many of them do really, really amaze me. In some countries, the performers are extraordinary. In Holland, we already had the second season, and a young 12-year-old girl won because she was so extraordinary.
What did she do?
Well, she, you see, each week they perform, and she, one of the her demonstrations was so incredible. You know, if I relate to you, it might sound kind of not impressive, but when you see it with your own eyes, she dove into a water chamber, and each week there are three celebrities involved with their performances, and they're mega celebrities. And she asked one of the celebrities to whisper a secret into a wine glass. And then, and that was, you know, across the stage, far away from her. She was already in the tank. They asked the celebrity to walk over and tip over the wine glass into her water. And she simply came out and she said the sentence, the secret that he actually whispered into the wine glass. It was very beautiful, very eloquent, very aristocratic, and people loved her in Holland. And that's why she won. It's a lot to do, Howard, with charisma and personality and character.
Because it's one thing to have a gift if somebody has a gift, but you have to have what you have too, and that is an element of showmanship about it too.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I sit in my chair and judge, I'm not the final judge. The final judge are actually the people at home. They decide who stays, who leaves, but I do have the power to give immunity to one performer that impresses me the most each week.
So you can save somebody. I can't wait, Uri, and our time is limited now, but I can't wait to see this in the UK. I'm glad it's coming here next year, and I will certainly be watching that. Just very quickly, you and I talked over the years many, many times about Michael Jackson on various radio stations. I feel a gap in my life because he's not here anymore. You know, I feel a great affinity with him. He was there through my life. You were a friend of his. How are you feeling now about all of this?
Well, you know, Howard, and I've said this a few times, you know, the great tragedy of Michael's life is that he was never actually permitted to be the simple, humble man that at heart he always was. Instead, he was driven to stardom, what, at the age of 5 by a very ambitious father. And then he was dogged by controversy all his life. And, you know, you being a media person, and in a way, I'm attached to the media, I believe, and you might disagree with me here, but I believe that the media must take much of the blame for his slow destruction and eventual death, with his sanity buffeted and his health racked by the global bullying, because that's what it was. It was a global bullying nonstop, day in, day out, 24 hours a day. You know, to me, Howard, it is incredible that Michael stayed as normal as he was. And I know that sounds strange, but yeah, he's gone through
it. Well, I think somewhere, and maybe you can be a part of it too, Uri, we need the definitive book on this man's life and ultimate sad demise. Uri Geller, thank you very, very much, and I do look forward to the series, and I hope you and I talk again soon.
Thank you. God bless.
And if you want to know more about Uri Geller and his various works, you can go to his website, urigeller.com. And that was from a recent conversation at City Talk 105.9. Right, this is The Unexplained, edition 24. If you want to contact the show, you can do it through the website. Please always, when you listen to one of these shows, register a hit on this website, which is www.theunexplained.tv. Let's get to the main guest now. Let's cross to California, where we find somebody who's been on this show before, internationally renowned medium, James Van Praagh. James, thank you for coming on.
Hello, Howard. How are you?
I'm very good, James. How is the United States? How is the West Coast?
The United States is beautiful. Very sunny and happy and summertime, and it's beautiful.
But you're not going to be there for much longer because you're coming here, aren't you?
That's right. I'll be there in October.
And what's the deal there? This is, what, a tour of the UK? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm doing a tour with the British medium, Tony Stockwell. And he called me up and wanted me to do this with him years ago. And finally, our schedule's cleared up where we were able to do it. So I'm going to be working with him October the 5th in Brighton. And then we go to Cardiff and then off to Croydon. then Bradford, and then Brentwood, and then Blackpool, and then Newcastle.
You're going to be all over this country then, as we say in the UK, like a fiddler's elbow.
That's exactly right.
That's good.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but I think it's, I don't know what it's a bus and truck. I don't know what it's about. I don't know. I'm just going to go along with it. Whatever happens.
It'll be a great big Winnebago. It'll be fine.
I have no idea. It'll be bicycles. That's fine with me.
Tony Stockwell. Now, I know of Tony Stockwell. I've never talked with him, but I do know that he's one of the probably two most famous mediums, stroke maybe psychics, in this country at the moment.
Yes, he is a mental medium like myself, and he's done several television programs there, very successful programs. And yes, he's very well respected. I've seen a couple of his shows, and I do enjoy the way he does his mediumship, and I thought they would definitely complement. My mediumship and his mediumship would definitely complement each other. It's difficult at times because when you have two different styles, but we have seemed very similar, him and I. The big difference between American mediumship, the type that I've been around, and the British mediumship is that British mediumship is very much into survival, and that's it. And I've worked with many British mediums where it's about there's a lady next to you with brown hair, blue eyes, and she's a short stature, and she is wearing a pin dress. And the difference in American mediumship, or the way that I work, is not only do we bring through evidential, but also a sense of the personality comes through. And to me, that's very, very important because it opens it up a little bit.
Do you know what I think this is all about? We've talked about this before, James. I think the Brits have a different approach to all of this. The Brits need to see, because we're a skeptical and faintly cynical lot, we need to see evidence. We need to see proof. We want specifics. We want names. We want dates. And then once we've ticked all those boxes, maybe, just maybe, we can get some other information out. That's the way it works here, I think.
It's true. I think you're right. And if they don't like how I do it, too bad.
Hey, I know from our previous conversation, you don't care.
No. It's funny because I've been interviewed several times now with some UK people, and I've said that. My only concern, my reservation, is that they might not understand my sense of humor. I don't know what people said. Yes, they'll get along fine with your sense of humor. And, I've never gone into this work where I've cared what people think, in a way, because I think if you're true to yourself and you come from a place of love, then that's all you can ask for.
I think so, too. And you came from a background. You were born and brought up, weren't you, in New York? So if you can cope with New York, then you can cope with anywhere, I think.
Oh, that's true. That's the hardest crowd, the hardest audience, I think, in the world. I really do. I mean, the most obnoxious audiences in the world. And
they could be listening to you now.
That's good. They should, because you know they are. The funny thing, I have a funny story. I was once working there at a place called the Town Hall, and it had about 2,000 people. And I walked on the stage, and people were screaming left and right, and they wouldn't stop, and they wanted my attention. And, of course, I had to control it, because if I didn't control it, there'd be the outrage. So some lady was louder than everybody else, and she's screaming, and she said, if my brother came to you, why would he come to you? And if he did, what would he say to you? And I knew I had to take care of that right that moment. And I stopped for 2 seconds, and I looked up to her, and I screamed back, and I said, well, he would probably tell you to shut up.
Did she see the funny side of that?
She understood exactly what was said. She realized that she did the wrong thing. Everybody in the audience realized that that was not the right approach to, you know, to working, and that she's got to be careful and respectful, be very respectful. And now, of course, that started the whole evening off with respect, and that we can go on with it.
I want to try, if I may, James, on this not-so-great phone line, a little experiment with you now, if I can.
Okay.
Every so often, I tell somebody something that I don't think have known, and I don't want to know where that comes from, and I don't especially want to know what that is, because I'm a radio guy, that's my job. But every so often I'll get a word or a picture, and I'll tell the person, and sometimes it's right. Now, this is probably going to backfire really badly, but let's do it anyway.
Okay, go right ahead.
Before we spoke, I had a name, and whatever it was that was giving me this name was really insistent about the name. It probably means nothing, but does the name Martha mean anything? Do you know Martha?
Martha. Yeah. Martha. Martha. No, I don't know Martha. Mm-mm.
Okay,
no.
Well, I'm not going to do what people who sometimes do your job say. Well, you never know. Look into your background or look into the future.
Well,
Martha might mean something.
I'm not thinking of right now, but at the present time, right now, in my consciousness, I do not know a Martha who's close to me.
Okay.
But, hey, listen, Howard, I've done these things before, too, when I've been readings on the phone with people, and I've said a certain name, and they don't know what it is at the moment, but that day, they meet the person with that name. So
sure.
You never know how it's going to develop.
Yeah, and I think, as you say, as long as you do it honestly and sincerely, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, if it comes into your consciousness, then it means something. Something's going to happen with that. And I will keep that. I definitely will keep that because it will happen. I mean, it'll manifest in some way. I've done this so many years knowing that's the way it works sometimes. You know, it's so interesting, too. And then that could be the psychic part of you that got that name, but it also could be a spirit. Who knows? But I find that it's so interesting. What I love to study, the way people communicate. Like, everybody on this earth is very different. Everyone's unique, and their way of communication is different. Some people visual, some people emotional, some people auditory, and the spirit is the same way. Sometimes they don't know how to communicate correctly. So, you know, why would they communicate if they're not, you know, not doing correctly? They might not know the proper methods of how to get through something strongly. And, you know, like the name Martha, or let's say some lady came through, Mary, very quick. Mary. Well, it wasn't Mary, but it was Marie. But it's so similar and so close. You could barely, you know, see the difference. I mean, it's so close, Marie to Mary, so close.
And we're not computers, we're human beings. We have emotions and our own feelings come into this. So, of course, we're not going to be fantastically, I'm letting myself off the hook here, but we're not going to be amazingly precise.
It's true, very, very true. But then what it is, extremely, I call it like almost like cutting the knife. It's so precise. It's amazing. It's scary. I mean, I had since I've spoken to you last, I had an experience at one of my demonstrations, which, you know, I've been doing this so many years, but still when you get something through, and it's just so incredible. I mean, people say to me, gee, why don't you, aren't you jaded about this sort of thing? You've done it so many years, and you've seen so many communications and witnessed these spirits. I said, no, each one is unique. There was this little boy that came through to his father. A little boy. He was 15, 16, I guess he was. And the father was in my audience, and the father was drunk. He was completely drunk. And but the funny thing is, I looked over to him, and I saw a beautiful light coming out of him, that there was definitely some potential in him. And he was covering his pain with the drinking. Now, his son was standing behind him, and the son said, my name is Michael. So I said to this, now this man, Howard, you would not expect him to ever come to some spiritualist type of event like this. He was wearing full regalia of leather, as far as Harley Davidson jacket and pants and the long hair and the whole stereotypical biker look. And I said, there's a Michael, you said Michael behind you. Well, he went crazy. He said, oh my goodness, oh gosh, oh gee. He goes, that's unbelievable, you can't do this to me, no, this is too much. And his son Michael came through and said, my head, tell my dad, my head didn't hurt when it hit the ground. And the guy, again, freaked out. He goes, man, you're the real thing, man, you're real. And he started crying. He goes, my son died skydiving. Okay? And then he went on more details. And then finally, and now this is interesting because I'm thinking part of the reason maybe it was so successful was this man who was drunk. Because he was drunk, he was kind of, in a way, open, very open. He had no walls up to block anything, okay? So maybe it came through. I'm just thinking that maybe that was the way it came through easier.
Now, isn't that interesting? Because I've heard a lot of people who do what you do who say that the effects of alcohol actually close off your senses, and if anything, what they might invite in are bad spirits, bad vibes.
Very true. Very, very true. That's very true also. I agree with that. But then the last part of this was the son said, tell my father I loved the tattoo that he put on his chest. Now, the father then again jumped up and down on his seat. He rolled up his shirt. He goes, man, I can't say it on the radio, but he was using profanity. And he was like freaking out because this changed his life. He rolled up his T-shirt underneath his jacket. And on his whole chest, it said in tattoo, my beloved son, Michael. Okay.
Wow.
Now that is pretty amazing.
But there is no, unless you had X-ray vision and could see through the shirt, you would never have known that, would you? How could
no.
you have known that?
And then another thing, I mean, that's just incredible. Then how do I, as a human being, I mean, that's pushed me back. That was such an incredible detail. And I'm thinking, oh, I wish I had a camera on that to show people that happened. But then what happened right within seconds of that, a little girl in the back of the room, and it was only 100 people, a little girl by the 15 years old. And she raised me, because, Mr. Van Praagh, I was here 2 months ago with my mother and father, and my sister, older sister, came through, who had passed. And also my grandpa, my granddad came through. And then her father spoke up, and the father said, yes, my father came through, and he said to please tell my mother that it was time to go, and he's waiting for her. He'll help her over. And the man's mother was very sick. He said, Mr. Van Praagh, after your meeting, we went to my mother's house where she was ill, and we said, Papa's waiting for you. It's okay, you can go. He said, Mr. Van Praagh, she died 10 minutes later.
I wonder if that's something that you hear a lot of, because I've heard people say that to me, that sometimes people who are in that state where they're very close to death, and I have a story in my own family, my own mother, in fact, I was told, and I believe this.
Yes.
I said something to her that gave her permission. That's the word, permission to go.
That's correct. Mm. That's right. And sometimes they need permission to go. I have my father. He needed permission to go. My dad needed permission to go, and he wanted to know that his house was going to be taken care of. Believe it or not, he wanted to know. And he was running to his house. They wanted to make sure it was taken care of. He said, Dad, if your house will be taken care of. He died 5 minutes later. I mean, sometimes they need that permission that it's okay to go.
Well, my story is that my mum, she always worried about me. And, you know, James, from time to time, I'm afraid I gave her cause when I was younger to be worried about me too. So, you know, but I grew up and I said to her, she was
human. Yes.
Well, that's it. And she was in hospital and I said, and I don't know what made me say these words, but I said, Mom, the rest of it all now, the rest of the story is for you. Don't worry about me. I'm always going to be okay. I'll always get through. Now it's for you. Whatever happens next, it's all for you. And I thought she was going to recover and would come home and be okay. She died very soon afterwards.
Wow, that's a great story.
So I was told, and I do believe, and I don't think I'm a gullible person, I believe that in some ways, because she and I were so close, that was a permission thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, you should sit in a development circle, Howard. You really should.
Well,
you should have sit in the development circle because you're very, very intuitive. I think you have a bit of mediumistic ability, and that should be developed. I mean, because you do have such sincerity in your work, and you have sincerity, and that's a major part of sitting in a circle. I cannot tell you how many people sit in circles, and they just sit for the curiosity aspect. And you have such a sense of sincerity that you really want to help. You want to serve humankind, and you want to discover truth. And that's what you want when you have a subject to sit in a circle. And it's not easy to find.
Well, it's interesting, you know, James. And the reason I'm going to be totally honest with you here. The reason I haven't done this, well, there are two, and one of them is less important than the other. The important one is that I think I'm scared at some level of doing this because I'm not sure what I might unlock. And reason number two is I worry, although I've gone the extra mile in doing this show and I'm still working on mainstream radio as well, so I haven't been exiled from it, but I'm kind of scared that even in 2009, there are some people with closed minds out there who think if you do this kind of thing, you are a crazy man.
You can never care what other people think.
Yeah.
Because what they think of you is none of your business.
Hey, but you know the greatest thing about it, we both know this, I probably know it more than you do, getting older is the greatest thing because you do cease to care about what people think as much.
Yes, you know, at the age of 50, my sister said, when you turn 50, I can't use the word here, but she said, they'll just say, F it, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And I said, really? And she goes, yeah, you really won't care because, you know, you do your thing. And it won't. And I said, oh, come on, it can't be that way. She goes, no, it'll happen. You'll see. Well, boy, within 5 months after I turned 50, I certainly have that attitude. And it's true. And I mean, when I was in my 20s, I started doing this work. It was difficult because of all the skeptics that would come after me. And I was really the first one out there in America to go out and do it on television, and there I was open. I'm still open to skeptics, but you know what? I don't do it for them. You got to do it for the truth. You got to do it. Anyone who's wanted to change people's lives, anyone who wants to make a difference and change people's points of view, they're always going to be under the radar. They're always going to be under the gun. They're always going to be that, and they just have to have the courage and faith. It's almost like you know deep down that there is some that you know the truth. And you kind of have to share it with people and be an example of that. And don't let the naysayers, the skeptics, the people that live in fear override you, because life is a series of choices, and choices are based upon love or fear. And that's all there is. And what's the worst that's going to happen? You know, what's the worst that's going to happen?
What is the worst that's going to happen?
Yeah, like if you did this work, what's the worst that's going to happen? So you lose some listeners. But guess what? You'll gain a lot more.
Yeah. That's true. And, you know, one of the great things is this side of my interest I took to the internet. I was doing it on radio and the show ended. So I thought, OK, I'm getting requests from my listeners. Let's take it to the internet. They wanted me to do it. So I've done it. So now people who don't want to hear this don't have to. And eventually some of them will come round to discovering this stuff because their lives will change. But for right now, if they don't want to do it, then that's fine.
I have people, that's exactly true, because I have people coming up to me saying, I just read your book, Talking to Heaven. I just discovered this whole thing. And I said, well, I've been out doing this since 1996 with that book. So that was out, the book's been out over 10 years. I've been doing this work since 1990, so it's like, hey, but it's been a long time. And they said, well, I just discovered you. And a lot of them just discovered it. This is really interesting. When I first started working on Ghost Whisper, when I developed that show and created that show, I did that because Spirit said to me, we want to reach more people. The best way to reach people is through the medium, forgive the pun, of television. And really, it's true. And that show has reached over 400 markets around the world. And now when I do many of my seminars or workshops, I have people in the audience. The first question I ask them is, how many people is this brand new to, this first experience? 90% of the people raise their hand. And I said, well, how did you find out about me? And they say, through the show Ghost Whisperer. So it's very interesting because then it's reaching those people. The goal is being met.
But isn't it interesting that if you were to do this 20 years ago, I don't think that it would have had the same impact. It just happens to be that I think the time is right.
Yes, I think the time is right. I think it takes work. I think everything is an evolution. The consciousness evolves. I think people evolve. I also think, see, now as I talk to you, I pick up things. This is interesting. Just by talking to you. Not about you necessarily, but these insights of things. I think also when you give people information, and it opens them up a certain way. And then the more information, then that opens up somebody else. And it opens up, it's that monkey effect. That, you know, it opens up someone else, and someone else, and someone else. And everybody's had experiences. Everybody's had psychic experiences from one or another. Whether it's thinking about somebody, the phone rings, and it's that person. Or, the, you know, that intuition, that gut. Everybody's had that. And now it's a time where they can say, wait a minute. It's okay to use that. It's okay to feel that. It's okay to know things outside this physical realm. So it is, it's an evolution, but I think it started about 20 years ago, just feeding it to people like that.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk with you. I heard you talking on American radio. That's why I want to do this with you from a British perspective about your book, Unfinished Business. And it was one of the most moving and interesting things that I'd ever heard. And that was when I made a little note to myself saying, got to get James back on. So tell me about the book, Unfinished Business.
Well, for 25 years, I've been doing this for 26 years. I lose count after 52, because who cares? And what happens is, what happened was, Spirit said to me many, many years ago, when I first really knew or recognized my guides, who my guides were, and started working heavily with my guides, they said to me, we want you to write a book one day that'll help people. I said, okay, about life on the other side. I said, okay. And they said, you're not ready to write it yet, but make sure that you write down many of the messages you bring through, the most profound ones. Okay. So through the years, some of the most profound messages I'd get at meetings, afterwards I go back to stage and I write down bullet points of certain messages, kind of the most profound or most amazing or incredible stuff, just like this man with the tattoo. That's another one I would have written down. So I've written several books, I mean seven books actually, and then last year I just finished the book Ghosts Among Us, and Spirit said to me, okay, you're ready now. And I said, I'm ready. I said, we're ready to help you write this book. I said, okay, what kind of book is this? And they said, it's a book, it's a manual for living life well. And it's and then I understood what they were talking about. What it is when I do this work, and many, many mediums, I'd say the majority of mediums do this work, not only is there the survival aspect, but there's also a sense that the number one common message that comes through is a sense of regret and a sense of should've, would've, or could've. If only I know now what I knew when I was living my life on the earth, I would have treated people differently, I would have loved myself more, I would have believed in myself more, why couldn't I? So really this book is made up of hundreds of these messages from people who have regrets and misgivings and talk issues about forgiveness and guilt and how to deal with those things while you're still in the body. And so the book is really messages from those loved ones. It's a manual from the dead to the living, how to live life in a way where you will not have any shouldas, wouldas, or couldas when you pass out of the body.
So it's having those conversations before it's too late.
Yes, it's telling the father, I forgive you. I forgive you for what you did. It's calling up that sister you haven't spoken to for years and say, I know you did something that wasn't right, but I love you anyway. I forgive you. Taking the bigger picture, taking the higher road, and understanding that maybe she came from a different place. Maybe she was hurt first, someone else hurt her, and she took it out on you. There's always motivations behind people's acts, and you have to understand that. And if you look at things from the bigger picture, the bigger perspective, and I'm going to tell you something. The biggest thing we have, besides love, is forgiveness, power. And the power of forgiveness is so strong, that really could move mountains. Because when you can forgive somebody, then in turn they can forgive somebody else. And the act of forgiveness is a very high vibration. It works hand in hand with love. There's a great example I talk about in the book, and it's you don't know but it's somebody till you walk in their shoes. I once did this reading for a young lady, and she hadn't spoken to her father in a long time. He died 40 years earlier. And she was so angry with him, and all she said throughout the whole time she was with me was, why couldn't my father love me? Why couldn't he just say, I love you? Why couldn't he demonstrate love to me? Doesn't he realize he ruined my life? I can't trust men. Doesn't he realize he did that to me? Of course, throwing the responsibility onto her father. And I mean, she went on forever, about half an hour, 40 minutes, about, you know, going on and on about this sort of thing. And the father did finally come through. And I felt so sorry for this man. The father said to the daughter, I'm sorry couldn't tell you that. I was never taught about love when I was a child, so I didn't know how to show it to you.
Wow.
So, you see, you never know the backstory.
You never know the entire story behind that thing. And, of course, you can. It's not just the person who dies who needs this salving of conscience or whatever. It's the person who's still here, isn't it?
It's the person living.
Yeah.
You bet it is, because they're holding on to that stuff.
I'll tell you an example.
When you hold on to stuff, you can't let the energy flow. You can't be as true as you can. You can't be living it to your potential.
Well, listen, I've got a great example for you, and I don't know why I've just thought of this now, but this is to do with my dear departed grandmother, a real Liverpool, yes, Irish grandmother, tough lady but full of love. And, you know, she was very, very close to me. She lost her husband when he was 63, I think. He was comparatively young to go. He had a heart condition in the days when those things weren't as understood as they are now, and he probably would have lived a lot longer had he been around in this era. But, you know, that's gone now. The story is this. She had a massive row with him about 5 years, I think, before he died. And he called her some names, and it was the kind of thing that was said in the heat of the moment. He didn't really mean it. He didn't know how to say sorry. And she, more importantly, never forgave him. She said that she was able to forget. These are the words she said, I can forget, but I can't forgive. Well, who did that damage? Her more than anybody else.
Yeah, that's really, really bad. And that will affect her in every other aspect of her life. I have seen, I talk about this in the book also, and this is really, you know, it's so interesting for people to know. I think this. I mean, I was going to be a psychologist when I was younger because I love to study the human being. I just love the human animal. But as I do this work also, I'm evolving. I'm discovering things. And for this book, it's really interesting because at the vibration of this book, the words in this book are of a higher level. It's definitely the best book I've ever written, and people have said that over and over again to me. But it's very interesting. When I do readings now, and this didn't happen as much before, this wasn't as prevalent as it is now. After writing this book, when I start looking at people, I start seeing their blockages in their emotional body. So I can see the energy flowing from the top of their head down to the bottom of their feet, and it flows through the spine like a snake, okay, like a serpent. When someone is holding on to, whether it's guilt or whether it's a forgiveness issue, it's an emotional charge. It will stay blocked, whether in the heart chakra or the midsection chakra or the lower. There are three main emotional chakras, three main emotional centers. And I'll tell you, Howard, I've seen black, I've seen brown in certain of those emotional centers. And I know that person has unresolved emotional issues, whether it's through a marriage, whether it's through a parent, whether it's through a sibling or a friend. I see it. And they haven't dealt with it. And so the energy gets stuck, and if it gets stuck, it turns this horrible brownish-grayish color. And guess what then forms? Because the energy, the prana, the energy of life cannot flow freely.
I'd probably say disease.
Thank you.
Right.
Cancers, disease, dis-ease. Yep, cancers, all different types of problems. I can't tell you how many digestive problems people have because it's an emotional thing. It's amazing. It's amazing to me. I just worked at a workshop in upstate New York. It's called the Mega Institute. I've had several of British people come over, too. At the end of the week, I did this thing, which I don't do it that often, but I felt compelled to do it. It's called the Healing Circle, Healing Tower of Light. And each person goes through this, and I go into like a semi-trance, and I bring through several of my guides, and I'm kind of out of it. I'm kind of totally out of it. And a Swahili came through, a shaman came through, but I know, I'm aware of what they're doing, and they're pulling out garbage and crud from other people's emotional centers so the energy can flow. And I remember they were doing this, and this was a month ago. And I remember there were 100 people in this class, about 100 people. And some of those people, they were able to take away some of that emotional charge, negative charges. But some of them, they weren't able to because they said to the person, you have to be responsible for getting rid of this yourself. There's only so much we can do. It's interesting.
Gee. Well, I think that's some of the most valuable work that you can do. Now, listen, our time is limited, and this phone line hasn't been great. I'm really sorry. I'm glad you've been able to hear me. I want to talk about one other thing, if I may, James,
sure.
Before we get to talking about your tour. I just happened to see on your website you're involved in a TV project, and you're recruiting people. What's this? What's going on?
Yeah, recruiting people. I'm working with a station called the E Channel. It's a cable network. And I wanted to do some kind of transformational show. And the transformational show is, I told them I want to do a show which is help people embody mind and spirit on all levels. So if we have people, so I have someone who's like a psychiatrist. I have another person who is a life coach makeover. I have someone who deals with addictions. And then I have myself, which is a spiritual. And I have like a team of us. And we have an individual, let's say, who's having one lady in particular, which I liked. She was a lady who was living in her garage, in her parents' garage, mm-hmm. because she lost her job. Her husband lost his job, and he's hard of hearing. They have four kids. She works part-time at the church, and they just can't get by. And she's on depressive. She's very depressed, and she's on medication for it. That's someone who's perfect for this sort of thing because she doesn't believe in herself, so she can't get a job, and there's some abuse issues going on, too. So there's all of these things, and that's what that is about. That's that show. So we're casting for four or five participants that we can work with.
And they're kind of people who need a complete life laundry. They need the full, from the ground up, makeover, don't they? Emotional makeover.
Yes, they do.
Sounds good to me.
It's so interesting how people imprison these things in their lives. They imprison themselves. So it's hopefully going to happen. I hope it happens. I leave it to the universe. Whatever it's going to be is going to be, you know.
Well, I would say I have a very good feeling about it, but I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to. Hey, now listen, James, thank you very much. And like I say, thank you for persevering with this lousy phone line. When do you arrive in the UK?
Let me ask you, you're in London, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'll be in London on Monday. I think it is the 14th or the 20th. Let me just tell you one second here. I have to look at my book because I have. I'm Monday at media, so maybe I can do your show.
I'd love you to.
I'd love to. You're one of the nicest people over there. I've told you that before. London on the 28th of September. I will be there all day doing media.
Okay, well, let's see if we can make that happen. And are you coming? The other place that I broadcast in is Liverpool. Are you going near Liverpool? You should go to Liverpool.
You know, you tell me, because I don't know any of these places that I'm going to.
You've got to go to... I hope you're going to Liverpool, because it is the greatest city. It's the biggest melting pot. The Beatles came from there. And let me tell you, Liverpool now is on fire. It really is such a dynamic place. Got to go there.
Well, if I can't. You know, I'm following Tony Stockwell, whatever his venues are. So if I don't go this time, I'll go next year.
You'll love Tony Stockwell. He's a great London character.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, I spoke to him a couple of times on the phone, and we connected on the phone, and that's why I'm doing it, because I felt good on the phone with him. So
got to go with the flow.
I go to yeah, I'll be in. I guess the closest, I don't even know where Bradford is and Croydon. You know where those places are?
Well, they are. I mean, for you in America, it's no distance at all. But if I tell you that Bradford is like 200 miles north of Croydon, okay, 220 miles, 220.
Okay. I see.
So it'll be fine. I mean, you just get in the Winnebago, fire up the refrigerator, have some beers. You'll be there before you even know it.
I can have beers. I'm working that night.
No, quite right, James. Very good. Very controlled.
I would love to go to London pubs. I would love it. I mean, I've been to London pubs a couple of times, and I love it.
So. Now, you've got to do the whole experience, and now we're into what you guys are into. You know, the whole microbrewery thing, we're doing that too.
Oh, are you? Wow, that's interesting.
So come and see and experience and enjoy. You'll love it. You will.
Definitely. Okay.
Good to talk to you, James.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you. Appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you.
Good to have him back on this show. James Van Praagh, American medium extraordinaire. Thank you to Adam Cornwell for creating the website and for maintaining this website, the means by which we get out there to you wherever you are in this world. Please email me through the website, www.theunexplained.tv, with any thoughts and suggestions, your feedback on the show. Just nice to hear from you, to know that you are there. Remember, this is a cottage industry. It's all done on a very small scale. There is no big business, no radio stations, no bosses involved. It's just me and Adam and you. That's how it works. And we want to develop it. We want it to get bigger. Need your feedback. Now, very, very importantly, exciting news. September the 11th and 12th in Liverpool, my friend Dave Truman's Beyond Knowledge Conference has a very special guest star, and I'm really pleased I was able to help make this happen. Richard C. Hoagland, amazing American space expert. He will be there in Liverpool in the flesh and promises some revelations. So if you can get to Liverpool, search it on the net. It's the Beyond Knowledge Conference. This has been edition 24 of The Unexplained. Edition 25 is coming very, very soon. I hope you've enjoyed this one. Please keep in touch. Take care of yourself, and I'll speak to you soon here on The Unexplained. My name is Howard Hughes.